Okay, first of all, I apologize to anyone who looked at the title, either in the paper or outside, and thought this was going to be a field trip. We're not going fishing today. Sorry. However, I do have a fishing story. Have you heard about the man who was out on the lake all day long in the blazing hot sun fishing and did not catch even one fish? Finally, exhausted, he gave up and headed home. And on the way home, he stopped at the local fish market, and he walked in and said, "Give me 4 trout." And the fishmonger said, "Okay." And the man said, "Well, wait a minute. I want 4 of the biggest ones you have, and could you please throw them at me?" And the man said, "Excuse me?" And the fisherman said, "Well, I, in all honesty, want to be able to tell my wife that I caught them." And then the fishmonger says to him, "Well, you know what? I really think you ought to take the salmon." And the fisherman says, "Why? Is something wrong with the trout?" And the fishmonger says, "No, but your wife was by earlier, and she said to tell you this time she'd really like to have the salmon." Oh, come on, baby. So today we are actually going to look at another fishing story, and this another fishing story where the fishermen were unsuccessful. And this one is in the Bible in John chapter 21. And you all will remember from last week that Jesus appeared several times after the resurrection in physical form. He made a number of appearances to his followers, to Mary Magdalene, at the empty tomb, to the disciples who were hiding in the house in Jerusalem, and when Thomas was not present. And then Randy led us through a lesson last week where he met with them again when Thomas was present, and he talked to Thomas about doubt. Today's fishing story immediately follows in the Gospel of John, the story that Randy talked about last week, and this is the third time after the resurrection that Jesus appeared. And remember the number 3, because it's going to be important to our story. So our fishing story today is really a dramatic account vividly told in John. It begins with 7 of the disciples back on the Sea of Galilee. In just a second, I'm going to get my technology to work here. Here we go. Back in the Sea of Galilee, and you will remember probably from a former lesson that the Sea of Galilee is not a sea at all, but a freshwater lake located. It's actually the largest freshwater lake in Israel and the site of much of Jesus' ministry. We talk about the ministry on the shores of Galilee. So the 7 who were gathered were Simon Peter, Thomas, Nathanael, sometimes called Bartholomew, the sons of Zebedee, who were James and John, and 2 others who are unnamed. Bible scholars think that the other 2 were probably Andrew and Philip. So the 7 are together in Galilee when Peter announces all of a sudden to the group, "I've had enough of this, I'm going fishing." Well, the others say, "Well, okay, we'll go with you." So they go out in the Sea of Galilee as they had so many times before, and they get in a boat and they sail out into the sea, and they fish all night long and catch absolutely nothing. And so we're going to pick the story up here actually in John 4, and we're going to do John 21, 4 to 14, and it starts right after they caught nothing. "Just after daybreak, Jesus stood on the beach, but the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to them, 'Children, you have no fish, have you?' They answered, 'No.' He said to them, 'Cast the net to the right side of the boat, and you will find some.' So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it back onto the shore because there were so many fish. The disciple whom Jesus loved, and that would be John, said to Peter, 'It is the Lord.' When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on some clothes, for he was naked." Now, just a point of information here from the Amplified Bible. He wasn't totally naked. He was just unclothed from the waist up, which was the custom for the fishermen on the sea. And so he just put on his tunic in order to come to shore. And he jumped into the sea. But the other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, only about 100 yards off. And when they had gone ashore, they saw a charcoal fire there with fish on it and bread. And Jesus said to them, 'Bring some of the fish that you have caught.' So Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore full of large fish, 153 of them. And though they were so many, the net was not even torn. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." Now none of the disciples dared to ask, "Who are you?" because they knew it was the Lord. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and did the same with the fish. This was now the third time that Jesus appeared to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. And so the two other occasions that Randy mentioned last week occurred in Jerusalem. But we know exactly why the disciples are in Galilee, because several places in the Bible, but I'm going to read from Matthew 21:10, Jesus tells them to meet him there. He says, "Do not be afraid. Go out and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they will see me." So the seven are in Galilee following Jesus' instructions. But I'm wondering why in the world Peter decides to go fishing instead of waiting for Jesus, as he was told. Was he hungry? Was he bored after day of waiting with no sign? And did he just need something to keep him busy? The Interpreter's Bible, available in our lending library, notes that the disciples might have been expecting ridicule or experiencing ridicule on the street because of their master's crucifixion, and they maybe just needed a time to escape. Or maybe Peter, who was never long on patience, maybe his patience just snapped. As he watched those boats putting out, he said to himself, "I've had enough of this, I'm going fishing." And there's another possibility that gives this story really deeper meaning, and that is certainly the death of Jesus has thrown the disciples' lives into confusion and chaos. Perhaps Peter is so discouraged and so distraught about the future that in despair he turns back to his old way of life, to what he had done before Jesus commissioned them to become fishers of men. And the other six just followed Peter right back to the sea. And we can kind of understand it. Just imagine back to those familiar sounds and smells of being on the Sea of Galilee in the moonlight, hoisting the sails, feeling the familiar ropes in their hands, focusing only on those fishing nets just floating in the sea. And while going fishing might have seemed like a good idea to them at the time, a good plan, it certainly was contrary to what Jesus had told them just a week ago. In John 20, Jesus says to them, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, so I send you." And I sincerely doubt that Jesus meant to send them back fishing. And just think what it would have meant to Christianity, to the cause of Christianity, if those disciples had permanently returned to their old jobs. John's account tells us that they were out on the sea all night. There they are, all night on the sea. And this is kind of interesting because we read that they catch nothing. Well, four of them, Andrew, Peter, James, and John, are seasoned fishermen. They'd spent their lives on that sea fishing. So we wonder how they could be out all night and not catch anything. Exhausted and hungry, nets empty, hands empty, probably hearts empty, they see a man standing on the shore. But they don't recognize him as Jesus. And we might wonder about that also. They were only about 100 yards from the shore, the length of a football field. But perhaps it was overcast or foggy. I sincerely doubt it was as light as this picture shows. But or maybe they were just upset about their fishing failure, or so tired and hungry from their efforts that Jesus was not even in their minds. Could the deeper meaning here, however, be that the Christ is always present, but we are not always receptive? At any rate, Jesus addresses the disciples as children and says to them, in effect, "Catch any fish?" This reminds me kind of like that Dr. Phil question, you know, "How's this fishing trip working out for you, boys?" Obviously not too well. And then Jesus, still unrecognized, tells them to cast on the right side of the boat. They do so and catch a net full of fish. Because the disciples so readily follow the advice of the man on the shore, whom they don't recognize as Jesus, maybe something deep inside of them recognized the master before they became fully conscious of his identity. I'm not sure about that, but I do believe the most important question here is, what is the significance of the right side of the boat? Of course, it's possible that Jesus standing on the shore maybe saw a shoal of fish go by on the right side. That's possible. Biblical scholars insist that Jesus did not say the other side of the boat. He said the right side, even though Galilean fishermen always fished from the left. Is Jesus reminding the disciples and us that anytime we follow the guidance of Christ, unimaginable blessings flow? Or that once you go back on your true purpose, there really is no going back to the old way of being and thinking? Maybe that's why they didn't catch any fish. I do believe that Jesus is reminding each one of us to live from the right, our spiritual side of our being, to turn away from the outer world, that from old ingrained habits and thinking that doesn't serve us, to the Christ of our being, where we can always access our greater good. The right side is always on the side of power and truth. And metaphysically, the Sea of Tiberias, another name for the Sea of Galilee, represents spiritual insight, discernment, good vision, like spiritual vision, and the orderly expression in thought and word. And fish always represent ideas. And we are given dominion over ideas and thoughts. Whenever we live from the Christ of our being, the right side, our nets are filled with divine ideas, and we have access to an infinite store of wisdom and intuition. And in the story, finally it's John who recognizes Jesus, whereupon Peter, impetuous as always, grabs his outer garments and swims or wades in from the boat to the shore. Because of the shallow water, the other disciples come to shore in a dinghy, dragging the huge haul of fish behind them. When they arrive, Jesus is on the shore. There they are bringing the fish in, and there's Jesus on the shore. Jesus is on the shore cooking their breakfast over a charcoal fire, ready to feed their human hunger, just as he so many times has fed them spiritually. The fire is significant because only two times in the Bible is the term charcoal fire used, and the last time it was used was when Peter was sitting around a charcoal fire, and that's when he denied knowing Jesus. So when Peter sees that fire, surely it triggers feelings of pain and guilt and remorse. But Jesus is not seeking retribution. His goal is one of renewal and restoration. For this, after all, is Peter's story. It's all about Peter, the first disciple called, the one who represents faith, faith being that necessary foundation for the building of spiritual consciousness. And the writer of Hebrews referred to it as a verse I know we all know in Hebrews 11:1, the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. In other words, it is faith that enables us to look past appearances of lack, to perceive and believe in divine ideas, even when we do not see any evidence of them in the outer. And some of you, we studied this book in the 12 Powers class. Winifred Houseman says, in most people, faith does not come like a mighty thud, but instead, it comes gradually. Most of us need time to discover it, develop it, and allow it to express. And like all of our spiritual powers, we can use them in a spiritual higher consciousness way, or we can use them from what Charles Fillmore would call sense consciousness. And Peter, like us, falters several times when he uses his senses to look at the outer world and believe it is the only reality. And our story continues as Peter's lesson continues. And this will be verses 15 through 17. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? And Peter said, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my lambs." And a second time, Jesus said to Peter, "Do you love me, Simon, son of John?" And Peter once again replies, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And this time Jesus says, "Tend my sheep." And then a third time, here's the number three coming in, a third time he says to Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And Peter feels hurt because Jesus is asking him this three times. And he says, "Lord, you know everything, and you know that I love you." And Jesus says to him, "Then feed my sheep." So after the disciples have all eaten breakfast, Jesus singles Peter out, not once, not twice, but how many? Three times, in really what is a deep and profound question. And the question is, do you love me? And it's so interesting, the Amplified Bible qualifies this kind of love, the word that Jesus used for love, as one that is intentional, spiritual devotion, as one loves the Father. And actually, the first question that Jesus asked is not just, do you love me, but what did he ask? Do you love me more than these? So what in the world does these stand for? What is the antecedent for these? I think that's important for us to think about. Well, there are some possibilities. First of all, Jesus might have meant, do you love me more than you love your fellow disciples? That's a possibility. Or he might have meant, do you love me more than the other disciples love me? And a lot of biblical scholars say that this is what it means. And yet, does this sound like the Jesus we know? Does this sound like the Jesus who says, love your neighbor as yourself? And who always and always was chastising the disciples because they were competing against each other and asking who was the greatest? It doesn't quite ring true. And so I choose door number three, which is, do you love me more than fish, more than human needs, more than anything on the outer? Do you love me enough to turn to me before you turn to anything in the outer world? And that question repeated three times, as I'm sure it reminded Peter of the three times that he denied Jesus before the crucifixion. Yet that repeated question from Jesus does not sound punitive. He addresses Peter by the name he used when he first met him 3 years ago, Simon, son of John, as if Jesus were bringing Peter right back to the beginning, as if he was just erasing all of the faltered faith that Peter had exhibited. In fact, it does sound like Jesus is calling Peter to a renewal, a second chance to restore his faith, to choose whom he will serve, to live his life from his spiritual identity. And Charles Fillmore, in The Mysteries of John, also available in our lending library, says that Peter's three successive affirmations of love represent fulfillment of the close Christ union in our threefold nature, spirit, soul, and body. Those of you who took the Lessons in Truth class will well recognize this graphic, and I remember walking down not very long ago through the Sunday school, and there was a chart with spirit, soul, and body on it. I was so impressed that our kids were learning that. I wish I had learned at that age. But at any rate, spirit stands for our Christ, our Christ within. So our soul is our mind, both conscious and unconscious. And the body is not only the body itself, but the outer expression, all the sensory data that we take in with our body. And so you'll notice that each time Peter says, Lord, you know I love you, Jesus responds with, feed my lambs, tend my sheep, and finally, feed my sheep. Jesus is trying to help Peter and us, I believe, understand that spiritual enfoldment is absolutely contingent on love, and that the test of love is a willingness to serve. Faith without love will always falter. But Fillmore says that faith established in love and by working through love will remain steadfast. It will be our sustaining power every hour of our need. And also, the Metaphysical Bible Dictionary notes that lambs and sheep are the most harmless and innocent of all the animals. They represent the natural life that flows into man's consciousness when man is attuned to spirit. It is pure, innocent, guileless. And when we open our minds to the realization of spirit, we open the gate to the kingdom of heaven within. So in the end, this lesson is all about choice. Again, from the Mysteries of John, the net of man's thoughts works long and hard in the darkness of human understanding and gains little. But once the Christ mind is perceived and followed, the net is cast on the right side and success follows. So yes, in our human selves, we can work and strain and toil in the dark of the night, which means without spiritual understanding. And probably we too will catch no fish, no productive ideas. Oh, we might catch a few, but if we do, we will just be exhausted and depleted in the process. I've been there. Anybody else been there and done that? And the good news is our souls are pivotal. And that means that we can at any time, any moment, in the face of any problem, we can turn to that problem. We can turn to that physical side. We can struggle with a diagnosis. We can labor over a pitiful bank balance. We can worry and stew about a failing relationship. Or we can turn our pivotal souls to the Christ and on the side of what is spiritually true. And when we turn to God, knowing that we are one with the Most High, that we live and move and have our very being in spirit through our own indwelling Christ, we have access to all divine ideas. So, the next time you're going fishing, whether it's for trout or salmon or for healing, prosperity, divine order or harmony, ask yourself this: am I working on the right side of the boat? And so we'll take a moment now to affirm what that right side of the boat is, to affirm that right side where we know and live from the truth of God. There is only one presence and one power in the universe and in my life: God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life: God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is.